This season of the Future Great City podcast is sponsored by Red Brick Realty, a new full-service boutique brokerage firm focused on helping you buy and sell residential, commercial, and investment properties. Tell Red Brick you heard about them here on the Future Great City podcast, and you'll receive $500 off buying or selling a home, apartment building, or commercial property. You can reach Scott Sturdivant at 314-420-9491 or Scott at redbrickstl.com.
Urban Improvement Company UIC is pleased to sponsor Next STL's Future Great City podcast. We believe in design as a dynamic change agent in the development of smart, sustainable neighborhoods and cities. Our passion is bringing expertise in architecture and construction to everything we do, creating exceptional results regardless of scale or project type. With optimism and ambition, we remain eager to forge new relationships, enter new markets, and continue to be a proactive part of our clients' successes and the successes of the communities we work in. UIC, we develop, we design, we build. Visit UICSTL.com.
This is the Future Great City Podcast from NextSTL.com.
So we are joined today by the treasurer for the city of St. Louis, Tashora Jones, a candidate for the mayor, the position of mayor for our city. The primary is coming up in just about a week. We have our choice of a lot of different candidates this year. And as we were just talking, the first, in some ways, the first real campaign with real options in the last, 15, 20 years. So welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we are 7 days out, right?
Right.
So has it felt like a long campaign to you?
Absolutely. I am exhausted, even though, it's a kind of a sprint after New Year's Day, but I'm exhausted because it's been something going on every day.
Yeah, and for some people that don't know, this is the Democratic primary is coming up in a week's time, and that's really the election, in a sense, for the city. Is that correct? I don't know if that's how you're allowed to say it that way, because there is a general election after that.
But. Right, and there are, according to the Rock and Roll Libertarian, six candidates after the primary, because they'll still be, two independents, Libertarian, Green, Republican, and a Democrat.
Okay, well, so have you kept track of how many different panel discussions you've done and how many interviews and how many roundtables and things like that you've been through in the last couple months?
I've lost count.
Yeah, this is what surprised me is that it's got to be in the dozens. And I'm just surprised. I'm sure in some respects you feel obligated. You have to do all these things. You have to talk to me, right? You feel obligated somehow. But but you guys are working hard. I mean, in the last couple elections I've seen, there have been one or two discussions or debates, but nothing like what we've seen this year.
Right. Well, there are multiple candidates, so we're giving people multiple opportunities to see and hear from us.
And, let me ask you this. What factors went into you deciding to run for mayor?
It wasn't something I thought of automatically. Even when Francis Slay announced that he wasn't going to run again on April 8th, I wasn't about to just jump right in. I had a whole host of things I needed to think about. First and foremost being my son, who's 9 years old, making sure that whatever I decided to do, that I would still be able to take care of him and be a mom and be there when he needed me. And then also I thought about, what little anonymity I have left as a citywide elected official. Not many people know who the treasurer is, and still being able to go to Target and get my grocery shopping done. mm-hmm. But I had to be convinced. This wasn't a decision that I, just automatically made. There was a draft Tashora movement that went on for several months.
Yeah. So you're saying the draft Tashora movement is that was effective, I guess. Obviously, you're running. So.
Obviously it was effective, but it didn't happen overnight. A lot of prayer, a lot of, pro and con list that I made on my own, and And then a lot of talking to my extended family to see if this was something that, you know, we all wanted to do because we make decisions as a family.
And so this may say more about me than you, but my timelines on Twitter and Facebook are heavily pro Tishora. So this is the, if I can so characterize them, it's the largely white, largely Cherokee Street-based South City progressive movement, the anti-tax abatement people, the pro-public school group. How have you done that? I don't know if that's the best way to phrase it, but it's, you know, you clearly have kind of cornered the market in a way among the candidates on the young white progressive. Is that the way to?
I'll say it that way.
You can say it however you'd like.
I wouldn't say cornered the market. You know, there are still a couple of other progressive candidates in the race. You know, I've always been the same person when it comes to things that I support. I support public education. I support using our tax dollars wisely. I support being innovative and being forward thinking. I support taking our government from the 19th century to the 21st century. I support equitable and sustainable development. And if that means that I corner the market on the progressive vote, then so be it. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't planned. I just wanted to make sure that we, meaning my campaign team and I, developed a good plan, a good platform that where everybody could find something that they liked that spoke to their values.
So how much have, and this, I think this is a corollary to that, how much have you benefited from not being an alderman? And in this case, with the race, you know, there's, as aldermen, I think, and I have people who I think are effective and people who I don't think are as effective, but the nature of that job is to care about 1/28th of the city, and you end up voting on a bunch of junk that you really don't care about. And it seems to me that you've benefited from that in a way because you haven't had to make a lot of those votes.
Right, I haven't. And in a prior life, I was a state representative and had about maybe a sixth of the city that I was responsible for. But even as a state rep, I always championed policies that affected everybody. I realized that my one vote did affect everyone in the state. And so I've always led from that place of how do I support policies that lift all the boats in the tide and not just the wealthy few. And not being an alderman gives me a in my opinion, a holistic view or somewhat of a 10,000 foot view of always looking out for everyone, not just the people in my ward. And because I'm not an alderman, I've always been a citywide elected official, at least for the last 4 years. I've been very cognizant of the decisions that we make and how it affects everyone, no matter what corner of the city they live in.
So let me ask you this. I don't know that a lot of people, and frankly myself included, really understand well the job of the treasurer of the city of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Can you take a moment just to tell people what ground you cover, what your responsibilities are, and what you've done with it?
Sure. The treasurer is one of 9 citywide elected officials, or one of 6 county-wide elected officials, because St. Louis is its own city and county. And the treasurer is the chief investment and cash management officer for the city, as well as the parking supervisor. So on the treasury operations side, as we like to call it in the office, I'm responsible for all the banking relationships for all of the city departments. And even though they have their own relationships, they still have to report that to us on an annual basis. We also approve all of the banks that can do business with the city on an annual basis through being chair of the funds committee, which is consists of myself, the mayor, and the comptroller. We also print payroll checks. So we made a move 6 months into my first term to take all city employees from checks, from hard checks to mandatory direct deposit, and ended up giving about 800 citywide employees who had never had access to a bank account before their first bank account.
So I mean to interrupt, but that's remarkable, right? Like it's 2017. So you did this, what, last year, the year before, direct deposit. Like sadly, that's like a big victory, right? To get direct deposit for city employees. Like, I don't know. Is that, I guess that's got to be kind of fulfilling, but it's also kind of sad, right? Like these are the battles you have to fight.
Exactly. We found that 1,600 people weren't using direct deposit for whatever reason, and 800 of them, about half, weren't using it because they didn't have a bank account. So we held bank fairs at different city departments or different city buildings, and gave people up until June 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year, to choose their bank account. They could either choose one of the banks or credit unions that we provided them access to. They could interview on their own, or if they didn't, then we put their benefits on a pay card, which was free to them as long as they stayed within the parameters of that pay card. And what we found recently, when we looked back at how many people still have the pay card, only about 300 people still have the pay card. So that means that either 500 people got fired, which I don't think that happened, or 500 or so people moved to mainstream financial services, which is what we want to happen.
Great. Well, so let's cover parking real quick. What do you do? And if I remember correctly, and you feel free to correct me, but when you ran your campaign for treasurer, one of the things you talked about was getting parking out of the treasurer's office,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That hasn't happened, and there may be a reason. So
the treasurer is the parking supervisor because back in 1951, Jim Dwyer was the president, was the treasurer then, and went to the legislature and said he wanted to be the parking supervisor because the treasurer's office is a creature of state government, not municipal government. And so laws that govern the office are at the state level and can only be amended at the state level. So back in 51, he became the parking supervisor, and then subsequent treasurers built somewhat of an empire of parking. And now the treasurer's office, via the parking commission and the parking supervisor, we're able to build garages. Our credit is rated separately from the city, which just got upgraded while the city's was subsequently downgraded during my term. And also, we are able to write parking tickets and about parking meters. So that's the entire operation.
Mm-hmm. And you've led part of that effort to actually be able to pay with a credit card at parking meters. And again, some of these things that maybe we shouldn't still be trying to get done, but we're that's where we are. Right?
Exactly. You can pay for it by credit card at any city parking garage now. And you can pay via app Park Louie at any parking meter.
Sorry, should parking be part of the treasurer's office? Is this, I mean, if you think ahead a couple more years or 5 years, or if you could just kind of wave a wand and make it happen, what would that look
so
like?
So we looked into spinning that off and putting it back under streets. And where we found the issue was that there's a lot of debt that has been accumulated under building the garages. So there are about maybe two or three outstanding bond issues that are attached to the treasurer's office. When I talked about how it's its own empire and has a separate credit rating from the city because we can issue our own debt. As a result of that, if you spin it back off and put it back under the city, then the city then becomes responsible for that debt. That adversely affects the city's credit rating. So we didn't want to put an additional burden on the city. And so we felt that it was best to keep it under the treasurer's office, plus all of the unwinding that you have to do with the bond issues that are currently attached to the office. You'd have to go back to every bondholder and get their approval in order to do that.
Is it still a long-term goal in your mind? Does it still make sense long-term?
I think some changes are definitely in order for how that happens, and definitely we're looking at some options. Still not married to any one or the other. But now that we pay for a portion of the other thing that the treasurer does is the Office of Financial Empowerment, and a portion of residual parking revenues after our bills are paid and after we split a portion with the city goes towards those programs, in particular the College Kids Children's Savings Account Program that gives a college savings account to every kindergartner in a public school.
So, and you found other things to do with parking revenue, right? So just this past year, you allocated money for Metrolink, a North-South Metrolink study through parking revenue. Can you tell me why you did that? And it doesn't seem like something that, I guess I was surprised. Like, that's a real progressive thing that I think people in St. Louis would see other cities do and say, oh my gosh, like, why don't we do that? Using parking revenue to study transit sounds great. Were there any hurdles to doing that? And how did that come about?
Well, legally, we had to find a way to do that. And because parking along Metrolink lines requires a study in transit-oriented development and studying the parking along the lines, we felt that was something that definitely tied into our mission in the treasurer's office, you know, and our functions in the treasurer's office. So that's why we put money towards updating that study, because we have to get back in the pipeline to update our transit. Any mark of a first-class city, in my opinion, is the transit it offers to its citizens and its visitors.
And you've been on record of this, but you're clearly, as a mayor, it would be pro North-South Metrolink and continuing studying that. And like you say, getting the pipeline for when there is money.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So updating the study is going to take another 18 months or so. That process has just started. And then, after the study is completed, then we go back to the Federal Transportation Authority to try to see what we can do to get a 50% match to build the line.
So how does that play? I mean, locally, we see this playing out as kind of an adversarial relationship between the city and the county, and the county executive, Steve Stinger, not being able to decide which contractor to hire or which routes to study. And it seems like there's no agreement. And what it feels like is that this is just another case where we're going to be fighting each other over limited resources, and we're never going to be able to come to a consensus on what to build. How, you know, the mayor's position is kind of famously a weak mayor system, right? And that's kind of sometimes used as an excuse, but it's also reality. How can the mayor work with St. Louis County, and not just St. Louis County, but everyone else, you know, on East-West Gateway, on all these places to get something like this done? Because, I mean, I don't need any convincing to understand that urban transit makes more sense than building rail lines to Westport or to St. Charles. What could the mayor of St. Louis do that maybe either hasn't been done or has to be done going forward to make sure this line is what gets funded regionally?
I think we have failed in building relationships having discussions around public transit and other things, that other issues that plague our region. And I think that we need to make sure that not only we have relationships with county executive, but the other mayors that are there, you know, of all of our municipalities.
Right. We can't assume that the county executive speaks for the county in a lot of cases.
Right. Because, you know, you and I both know that the county executive is only the executive over the unincorporated parts of St. Mm-hmm. Louis County.
Which makes me think we're going to get a Metrolink line that, like, weaves through the municipalities, you know, like avoids all of them and just serves unincorporated county just because,
you know. I'm going to be cautious. I'm going to be optimistic, Alex, and I'm going to think that we're going to get there. Because I think what we have to start doing is developing relationships, at least with the mayors of those ring cities that touch the border of St. Louis. So let's start there. Let's work our way out. You know what I mean?
Sure. No, I'm with you. And one of the things that I think hasn't worked, and I don't know if it's, you know, I don't know how, what impact the mayor can have, but it does seem over the last, you know, we'll talk about Mayor Slay's term, 15 years, that we haven't seemed to build those bridges. It seems like, you know, St. Louis doesn't have a better relationship with Maplewood than it did before, or Clayton, or even the obvious, you know, the ones that we border. There doesn't seem to be any particular cooperation, and I don't know what ideas you have to make that happen, but it just seems like it's so ingrained in St. Louis that these are, you know, these places might as well be separate countries.
Right. And as treasurer, I've reached out to mayors of some of our inner ring suburbs. I've met with the mayor of University City to see how she and I can work together on expanding financial empowerment initiatives to county residents and coming up with ideas on places where we can put additional financial empowerment counselors or financial empowerment centers. I've worked with Clayton and UCity on obviously parking and parking meters. Clayton's staff came to visit us one day to see, you know, what we were doing, how we were doing, and what equipment we used. And if you notice, we use the same vendor for parking meters, Parkeon. But they decided to go with a different app for their downtown meters called Passport. And it's not like St. Louis couldn't one day adopt that app, because you and I both know technology changes as soon as you put it out there.
Right. No, you were already in a situation of having multiple apps just to be able to park, you know, around the region. So, So you've talked about this a lot, is bringing ideas from elsewhere, you know, and I helped host a forum the other night at Cortex, and we talked about fiber from Chattanooga and some of the relationships you have there. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because I do think it's to our detriment in St. Louis that we think we're very exceptional and all these problems kind of only exist here. But obviously those ideas from elsewhere have limits, right? They do have to be adapted to here. But I want to give you a chance to talk about some of those things that you think could be learned from other places.
Yeah. So the mayor of Cincinnati, John Cranley, is a good friend of mine as well. And John, and you remember, Cincinnati went through its own racism and racial problems in the early 2000s. And John and I are part of a fellowship program where we got a chance to spend like 4 or 5 days together, you know, talking about why we are public servants through the Aspen Institute. And on our off time, he offered me the opportunity to come to Cincinnati to see what they did, like what coalitions they built to make sure that everybody's at the table. And I don't think we do enough of that. We don't talk to other mayors or other elected officials in other parts of the country to see what we can learn from, how we can learn from them. The mayor of Denver is a great friend of mine. Met him through this same program. And they're doing some amazing stuff with funding affordable housing and building up their affordable housing trust fund. Now, we don't have marijuana money, but we do have...
Not yet.
Let's hope so. I'm totally for that. Let's tax it and legalize it. But, you know, there are things we can learn there. And also, they just finished a $2.2 billion line to connect the airport to downtown. If you've ever been to Denver, you know, that's quite a hike. It's at least a, you know, 20 or 30 minute drive. And they did that through a public private partnership. I don't even think that's even been on the table as an option for St. Louis to fund our line. And then I talked about the mayor of Chattanooga, Andy Burke. And Andy told me how they expanded fiber and now offer internet as a public utility. And so there's two things that happens there. So people get access to internet, which a lot of people don't. If they're low income, they offer it for a lower rate. And then also, so they're able to, you know, get access to, you know, in-home jobs or whatever, you know, people like to do with the internet in their home. But it's also a utility, so it's a revenue generator for the city. We have to start looking at different ways to get different revenue sources into our city, because we can no longer just rely on the personal property tax, sales tax, earnings tax. We have to look at other sources of revenue.
Gotcha. So I think people would be excited about bringing some of those ideas here and understanding, you know, getting St. Louis connected to some other cities and you know, a lot of us follow these trends in other places, and we always, now there's the problem where, you know, have you seen these studies where on Facebook you see all your friends' vacations and like then your vacation doesn't seem as cool because you're like, you're seeing 30 other vacations. So there's a little bit of that happening in cities because we're doing a lot of great stuff here, but there's a lot of, you know, we kind of look across the country and we pick out, you know, one good thing that Cleveland's doing and one good thing that Denver's doing. And we wish we could do all of it, you know, so, but I think that's a great, you know, it's great to have our eyes on other places and understand, you know, so we're not starting from scratch and everything. Past that little aside was that, you know, you've been, I don't know if the right way is confrontational, but obviously your letter to the Post-Dispatch got a lot of play, got a lot of notice around the country. One of the things in there that I'm not from Texas, but I'm a little sensitive because I'm not from St. Louis. And so when I was reading some of that, I kind of thought, all right, well, you know, what I want to ask you is, who gets a say? You know, who does get to speak up and say what St. Louis is and what we should be and what you should be doing and that kind of thing? Because part of that, and I'll let you characterize it as well, but part of the letter was that I believe the writer for the editorial at the Post-Dispatch recently moved here from Texas. Well, and so one thread through that commentary was, hey, dude, you're from Texas. You're new here. Let me explain kind of some of the things that are happening. And so, and I get where you were coming from in a lot of ways, but like I said, I've gotten that a lot in St. Louis. It's like, hey man, you're from Indiana, like, you know, wait your turn or be quiet kind of thing. So maybe you can, I'll let you talk about how that, what you meant by that. And then who gets to say, you know, who's a St. Louisan? Who gets to say what we're supposed to be doing?
Well, it wasn't to say that, you know, you're not a St. Louisan and you don't know, but, you know, it was more in response to his recent, you know, there was an editorial he wrote that the next mayor has to have graffiti and blight.
Yes. On the agenda. So it said the line was something about how graffiti is ruining our city, right?
Right. Killing our city.
Killing our city. Yes.
You and I both know that graffiti is not killing our city.
Oh, we've celebrated graffiti on Next STL. We have a whole series that we funded about graffiti. It was beautiful. It was great.
But is it killing our city?
No, it's actually, there's some really nice graffiti out there. So.
Right. And graffiti. And I agree. Graffiti, or art used in a positive way is actually good for the city. And I've seen some beautiful graffiti artists around town.
You felt it was just kind of, it's the same old line that we've heard before, you know, like clean it up, tear down vacant buildings, wash all the graffiti off and everything's great, right? Like that's a way to fix the city.
That's a symptom. That's not the root cause. And I am looking at the root causes. More first and foremost, you know, what are the root causes? You know, the redlining, the racism, the, you know, not taking care of our people, not being smart on crime, having a workhouse that treats people inhumanely. You know, our problem with, you know, that we're on the front page for, you know, our relationship between the Black community and our police force. You know, and I can go on and on and on, but you know, graffiti and blight is not killing our city.
Why have some of those things that you've talked about? And I'm interested. Everyone's interested in solutions. You know, how do you get creative and smart on crime and things like that? But I also sometimes feel like there just aren't good answers, right? And so anyone who tells you they know how to fix crime or knows how to do something else is I don't know. I have a hard time believing it. So, I mean, feel free to talk about that because I think it is good to share ideas. But I'm also interested in how has it gotten to this point? Like it seems in some way – there are lots of people out there working really hard on these issues, but it also seems that St. Louis has gotten really comfortable with these problems. We know that the poverty rate in our city. We know that, you know, 25% of residents in North City don't have access to a car. We know kids are going to school hungry. We know our education system is broken. And it's been, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years that we've – it's starting to feel like we've come to accept it, if that's the way to put it. How does that happen?
Stockholm syndrome. And we have our heads in the sand, and we should not accept this as the normal, as the norm, because it's not normal for all those things to happen, the things that you mentioned. And we need a mayor who's going to use that office, even though people might consider it as a weak mayor system. It's only as weak as you make it. And we need someone who cares about people over projects and profits and developers. You know, and I'm not against using tax incentives where they would help a project, but I also want to make sure that that we hold our developers accountable to the things that they say they're going to do, and then also put community benefit agreements on every major development to make sure that we're getting a return on our investment of tax dollars. When we use TIFs and tax abatements, that's money that could go to our schools. And we've seen, you know the numbers, $700 million over the last 15 years, and 85% of that went to downtown and the Central Corridor, whereas 15% went in North or South St. Louis. That shows a clear pattern that that whoever is, you know, whoever's at the top was only concentrating on one part of the city or two parts of the city. We have to concentrate on the entire city, because North St. Louis and parts of South St. Louis have gone neglected for too many years, and we can't be everything that we can be if half of it is left to fend for itself.
And how do you support neighborhoods? Because, you know, in some of those numbers, I mean, there are a couple different ways to look at it. A lot of those, a lot of those big numbers happen in the Central Corridor because, in some cases, that's where our institutions are. You know, that's where the Washington University School of Medicine is. That's where St. Louis University is. That's where, you know, and that's where some of the massive vacant buildings are. So when you think about, you know, where are tens of millions of dollars in subsidies and development going to go, in some ways, it's natural that it's going to go in those areas. But does – so there are two ways to look at it. One is, does a central corridor that's very strong and growing in population and a downtown that's doing the same as that, does that help the surrounding neighborhoods, north and south? Is it a detriment to those neighborhoods? And regardless, how do you get into you know, Marine Villa and help? How do you get into the Penrose neighborhood and help? You know, what are we, what is the biggest impact you can have in those neighborhoods?
Well, as you've seen it, they've been thinking that some this sort of trickle out economics was going to happen, and it hasn't. And we have to start paying attention to the entire city. And I'm in favor of putting together a citywide development plan with input from all of the neighborhoods. And making sure that we identify where our deserts are of affordable housing, of safe housing, where are homeless shelters, retail, bank deserts, food deserts, because we do planning right now in a vacuum, or it's whoever, you know, a developer brings a deal to the table with tax incentives already baked in. Because some of those projects would have happened anyway. Without the tax incentives, I think Whole Foods would have located in the West End without the tax incentive. So we need to be more responsible about our development and push development in other places. We know that, you know, tax incentives or tax credits, you know, are on the chopping block, as they have been a topic of discussion since I was in the legislature in 2008. And if we know that, and if we have a citywide plan and we know where some of our historic tax credits are most useful to the to the surrounding neighborhood where those tax credits go, let's push them there and have a larger plan to work within and be strategic about our investments, not just using automatic courtesy like we have in the over the last 15 years.
Yeah, well, what really strikes me watching a lot of this development happen in the city is it truly is ward by ward, whether it's abatements or traffic studies. I mean, an alderman has to decide whether to pay for a traffic study just for a single ward, which makes no sense with all the streets coming and going out of it. So how do we get from here to there, so to speak? Because I also tell people we're not a poor city. You know, voters voted to give $120 million to a national park a few years ago. Right. We vote in tax districts over and over and over again. We've supported transit. We have money. It's just we've lacked the vision of where to direct that money. So how do you, I mean, is it a bond issue? Is it a new tax? How do you find money or allocate money for comprehensive planning and some of these things that you're talking about?
I also think we haven't taken a look at all of our revenue sources for years as well. I mean, we spend a lot on tax abatements and TIFs, but let's spend some time on our revenue sources. When I got in the treasurer's office and we looked at the laws on the city and state level that govern the office, we noticed that some of them hadn't been updated since the 60s. So, and I don't think that is too much different than with some of our other revenue sources or our fee structure. And we have to make sure that they are all updated because we are, in my opinion, looking at or addressing 21st century problems with a 19th century form of government.
Let's cover the election itself, because I'm curious how you look at it in terms of the field. And I don't know how much you're willing to share or what you think about it, but we have I'll put it my own terms. We have four or five kind of major candidates, leading candidates, so to speak, and Lyda Crewson being the only white leading candidate, and then a range of black candidates across the city. Our city is about 50-50.
Right.
So the conventional wisdom and the way that Mayor Slay won every time was to simply dominate South City and especially Southwest City, where most of his votes came from, kind of split the central corridor, and then voter turnout in North City was less than South City. And now the trends are going where there are fewer black voters than white voters, I think, depending on how you count registered voters. It's close to 50-50. But the city lost more black residents than white residents in the last census. So that's where I got that from. How do you see the race, though? I mean, are you – no one wants to see it in those terms, but obviously that's part of the calculus in trying to figure out where you get your votes from.
I don't see our voting demographic as monolithic. So you're right. In years past, if there was more than one black candidate on the ballot, the black candidate split the vote and the white candidate won because they snaked right up the middle. But if you look at 2016 with Vernon Betts' race for sheriff, there were three black candidates and one white, and Vernon Betts ruled the day. I think he got about 40-some-odd% of the vote. There were two blacks and two whites in Kim Gardner's race. Same thing happened there. You also look at, I think we're also paying attention to where the progressive votes are coming from, and all of South, or several, 12 wards in South St. Louis voted for Bernie Sanders in the presidential preference primary. So that, in my opinion, tells me that there's a progressive base there, and they're ready for someone who has a progressive message. We are getting requests from parts of town that, I'll be totally honest with you, I didn't think that there was any support, especially for a black candidate, to support me. And that is, you know, typically in the southwest corner of the city. So we are leaving no door unknocked and no phone uncalled to try to make sure that, you know, get our message out about being the most progressive candidate in the race.
Now, what's your take on the, you know, I think the coverage of the race sometimes devolves to what can we dig up on someone, or what is another campaign feeding us? And so you get all these things about, you know, one candidate's, I mean, we're a small city, we have small wards. So we have a candidate's, you know, longtime friend who gets tax abatement. We have articles about your travel. What does all this stuff mean to you? Do you think it's just like people are just searching for things to talk about that's not policy related, or how do you look at those types of stories that come out?
Those old school politics of trying to dig out whatever we can on a candidate and try to turn things around to make him or her seem corrupt and inept. And I think also baked into St. Louis politics is, unfortunately, there are a lot of old school St. Louisans who think that black politicians are corrupt and inept first, rather than being reputable and honest.
You have to prove yourself to be honest rather than right. proving something bad happened, right?
Right. And, you know, let's also talk about the elephant in the room. I am sitting here paying for the sins of my father in certain rooms. And, you know, for your audience, you know, my father was former comptroller of the city of St. Louis and didn't leave office in such a good light, according to some. But, you know, what he did was 20 years ago, and I am not him. And yes, I did follow in his footsteps and get into politics, but don't make me pay for what he did. Because I'm my own person, and I have I've run my own office contrary to popular belief. People assuming that he runs the office is sexist in nature. So I think black politicians, especially black female politicians, have a lot more to fight against in order to prove ourselves than some of our white counterparts.
I mean, it has been amazing to watch how, I mean, I've seen your father on Twitter get into fights with current aldermen, you know, like just calling each other names and stuff. Like, it's really remarkable that with all of our problems, we haven't just gotten to a point where it's like, hey, let's talk about our problems instead of each other and about, you know, 20 years ago and things like that. But I guess you understand it. You come to expect it.
Social media, Alex, has made people keyboard vigilantes.
Yes.
And I have been on the receiving end of a lot of that myself. And use block and mute more than I'd like to.
Yes.
That's the only thing that keeps my sanity, then I'll keep using it.
It is amazing. I mean, I'm online, and if you're online, even if you don't do much, which I'm not a public figure, I'm not in office, I don't want to run, I don't want to do any of that. And I get just enough of a peek into that makes me think, why would anyone want to run for mayor? Why would anyone want to be mayor? Why would anyone want to be the treasurer? Because you just get abused, you know?
Dude, it is the most thankless job next to, I think, teacher.
Yes, right. Yeah. So you've obviously you have to tune some of that out, I guess. I mean, you have a magic trick, something you want to share to kind of get a thick skin and deal with those kind of things?
I've built up thick skin over the years, and you know, the kind of things I can't keep reminding myself are, you know, there's an old quote from Maya Angelou that when people show you who they are, believe them the first time. And then also, you know, I just kind of try to dust things off, you know, because when people attack you, that says something about them, not you. I believe in faith a lot. So I go to church, you know, just about every Sunday that I can. And that's the best part about this campaign, because I get to visit a different church every Sunday. but, you know, I have to stay prayed up. I have to, or else. And I like, a good glass of red wine every once in a while.
All right, there you go. I'll try that next time, maybe. Instead of typing, what I do is I type responses and I delete them. You know, it's very therapeutic.
Yeah, that helps too.
One of these times I'll get it wrong and I'll hit the wrong key, and then let's hope that doesn't happen. So I'm going to wrap up here pretty quick, because I've taken quite a bit of your time, and you have some campaigning to do. But let's run through a couple of quick issues, and you can either give a kind of an up or down or share your thoughts on it. But the MLS stadium, that's mm-hmm. going to a vote, and we don't want to jump into the particulars. The deal is probably not terrible by any. I mean, this is something I've studied, and as far as stadium deals go, it's not the worst thing the city could do or the worst thing voters can do. But what's your take on it?
I think that should be a regional project. Regional meaning other counties in the region should be sharing the cost, and they aren't. And so I can't support putting tax dollars towards a stadium, or, you know, make the people who are, you know, already putting in most of the money, make them pay for it themselves. And so I just can't support that. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. We have 99 problems right now and a stadium ain't one.
Well, I'll leave it there. So let's go on to some kind of merger, cooperation, whatever you want to call it, with St. Louis County. That's not on the ballot anytime soon, apparently, but where do you stand on that? And whether it's the city re-entering the county or the two merging?
I think the fear inherent in a city-county merger for a lot of people is that they don't know what it looks like. So I'd like to study other models of other metro areas that have been through this. Louisville, Indianapolis, Newark, New Jersey, for example, all have used different models to when they merge their metro areas. And then also, I think both the city and county could use some house cleaning and consolidation before merging. You know, there are things that the city needs to look at, like our looming $20 million shortfall, making sure that all of our pensions, our pension plans are in order, because right now the firefighters have two, city employees is underfunded. A whole host of problems that I think we need to look at. But also, you know, we can be more cooperative with other municipalities and other entities while we're studying this.
Gotcha. So let's touch on crime, because it's no fun to talk about, but it's maybe the issue dominating St. Louis for a very long time now. And as we've looked at it on Next STL, we've compared some of the homicide numbers, which is a real stand-in for crime, because I know all the numbers are up and down depending on the category. But when you look simply at homicide, and we compare similar cities like Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh, those cities have very similar population, very similar high school education attainment, very similar poverty rates, very similar racial mixes. Why does St. Louis have twice as many murders as some of those cities? What's going on here?
I don't know if they have discovered the secret sauce, but anecdotally, I would say that they probably invest more in prevention and deterrence methods than St. Louis currently does. I sat on a panel this morning at Northwest Academy of Law, and former Chief Isom was there, as well as Lieutenant Colonel Robinson. And both of them talked about being smart on crime or being intelligent on crime versus being tough on crime, because we can't arrest our way to lower murder rates. There's a small percentage of people that commit the most crime. And what are we doing to make sure that we're putting them on the path of prevention and deterrence? Kansas City's NOVA initiative, for example, has seen a market decrease in the number of violent crimes when bringing all of the resources to the table, the federal, state, local, houses of faith, nonprofits, workforce development, social services, to really put its arms around the root causes of crime and making sure that they can provide those resources for that small portion of the population that commits the most crime.
It seems like, as I read stories around the country, you know, Indianapolis had a spike in crime, some other places, and, you know, Cleveland hit maybe 100 homicides, and they kind of, I mean, you can sense real panic in the stories you read about it, and you just simply don't sense that here. It's a little bit of, oh, yeah, I mean, homicides are at 188, but car break-ins were down 5%. You know, it's a little bit of a, again, these things become normal in St. Louis, and it's really kind of shocking. So I don't know. Well, let me pivot to this. We have local control of our police department now for the first time since the Civil War. So this is a big victory for Mayor Slay. Somehow he got it done. I think he probably deserves a lot of credit for that. But at least homicides, again, have gone up since we've had local control. We have a police chief that's a little bit polarizing, I guess. What can you do as mayor, because you would have control of the police department, to make things better? And I guess, let me ask you directly, would Chief Dotson stay if you were mayor of the city?
So first thing I would do is find a new public safety director. The chief reports to the public safety director in the city of St. Louis. And the public safety director is not only responsible for the police, but also the fire department, as well as corrections. And right now we have a public safety director who's a nice enough guy, but we need someone who has experience in using all resources available, like I talked about, on the federal, state, and local level, and using the community to reduce crime in areas like ours or populations our size. And then the public safety director, who has experience, in my opinion, decides whether or not the chief stays or goes. But I would think that, you know, if we're bringing in new leadership at the top of our public safety department, we would have to look at leadership in all three of the departments that I mentioned, police, fire, and corrections, to move the needle significantly.
So let's end on this, because I do want to wrap up. So this is the Future Great City podcast, and we believe, I think, I'll speak for both of us, that St. Louis is a future great city. We're heading in the right direction. It's an amazing place to spend time and work and live. And if you fast forward, you've been mayor for a couple of terms now. What does a future great St. Louis look like?
Oh, wow. So I see where it's cool to live in North St. Louis again, where there's more development in parts of North St. Louis and parts of South St. Louis. I see us having a broadband like Chattanooga, where we are able to use that and monetize that as a revenue source for the city. I see where we have programs that really help our youth remove barriers to education by working with all of our schools, where we have a year-round youth jobs program, and where all of our students have access to college savings accounts, no matter what grade they're in, as well as any graduating senior has the first 2 years of either community college, technical college, or vocational school paid for by our local, you know, or paid for. I don't know how we're going to find the money that, but I'd like to see that as an option for our young people. Also, where we're taking care of people more, and where our population has started to grow, because people around the country start to realize that, hey, St. Louis really takes care of its people. Because I'm more concerned about now, what are we doing to stop population loss and take care of the people and institutions that we have now versus always trying to attract something else. What are we doing to press the reset button?
All right. Well, we'll end with that. Unless anything else you want to add? Did we miss something big?
Not that I can think of. We've talked about a whole host of things.
That's right. That's right.
Almost an hour. Yeah.
Well, good luck and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you to Red Brick Realty, the new full-service boutique St. Louis brokerage firm. Give Scott a call at 314-420-9491 and get $500 off by mentioning the Future Great City podcast when you close a deal with Red Brick.
Urban Improvement Company UIC is pleased to sponsor Next STL's Future Great City podcast. UIC, we develop, we design, we build. Visit UICSTL.com.
You can subscribe to this podcast via RSS feed or on iTunes, and can follow the site on Twitter at NextSTL. Thanks for joining us. Be informed, be engaged, be part of what's next. NextSTL.com.